Go ahead, Mr. Latimer.
Thank you. As I indicated, I represent the two parties, Mr. Borden and the personal representative. The case involved a shooting death. Mr. Gregory Boggs was shot to death by an officer, Officer Swanger, of the Prince George's County Police Department. The case was tried in federal court. Prior to that, the trial judge had denied a motion for summary judgment with respect to 1983 claims, assault and battery with respect to Officer Swanger, and it indicated at that time that if the testimony of Ms. Borden were taken into account, clearly there was a violation of the constitutional rights of Mr. Boggs. And also indicated that Ms. Borden, who was standing in close proximity and had suffered through this officer drawing his weapon and firing without provocation of any kind, would also
testify he got shot for no reason.
No reason. What she said was that they were there, they were standing. The officer approached. He approached in an arc. He was on the right side of them. She was standing with her left back to his, I'm sorry, with her right back to his left chest. The officer was on the right. The officer shot, striking Mr. Boggs. And the only thing he said was, "Put your hands up." And she indicated that that's what they did. He fired. Mr. Boggs then fell, slid down her back, as evidenced by the blood on the back of her pants, and that when he fell, she immediately went to him, kneeled next to him. He did not have a weapon or anything in his hands. And the trial judge, for reasons that are inexplicable, totally discounted the testimony of Ms. Borden and accepted the testimony of Swanger, which was diametrically opposed to that of Ms. Borden. The case law is clear that judges cannot substitute their opinion of the facts for that of the trier of fact. And in this case, the trial judge did exactly that. The trial judge even went so far as to suggest that the forensic evidence in the case supported the view of Officer Swanger, and therefore you couldn't believe Ms. Borden, when in actuality the facts are totally different than what the trial judge said. Ms. Borden testifies that her left back is, I'm sorry, her right back is on his left chest. He is shot 2 inches to the right of the midline of the chest. The autopsy report, which is contained in the record, indicates that the bullet was coming from right to left at an angle that was going downward, and that it was front to back. So if you follow that evidence, what she said was that the officer is on the right, she's on the left, he struck in the left chest, he falls down her back, and the blood is on the back of her pants leg, and that was shown to the court, to the jury. The forensic evidence supports exactly what she says as opposed to what Officer Swanger says.
Let me ask you this, and I could be wrong because I'm just thinking of this, but the judge didn't direct a verdict.
He did not.
The conclusion of the case. He granted summary judgment. So all this testimony that goes on at trial, I'm not sure is relevant to the question of whether or not summary judgment should have been granted. It seems like if we're only talking about summary judgment, we go back to the documents and evidence that existed at the time the summary judgment motion was made, as opposed to the what went on at trial.
Well, in this particular case, what the judge did was, after the jury came back indicating that they were unable to reach a unanimous verdict, the trial judge then directed the defendant to renew their motion for summary judgment.
Right, but he could have granted a motion for judgment as a matter of law.
He could have, but he denied that.
That's right, and he didn't. That's right, he denied that.
That's right.
So after hearing the testimony, he didn't feel like judgment was appropriate as a matter of law, but then he grants summary judgment, which is basically the same thing.
Exactly.
So there's inconsistency.
It's entirely inconsistent, and I don't want to speculate as to what was the reasoning behind it, but what I do know, and I have looked, I have yet to find a case where when you have facts that are disputed to the extent that these were, and even though the trial judge tries to rely on Anderson, on the Anderson case, and says that the officer had a much better vantage point, well, the facts just don't bear that out.
But the trial judge seemed to have turned it on, and I'm not quite sure I agree with Chief Justice Traxler on the timing of the summary judgment, but it maybe intuitively, if the evidence that's presented by testimony, even at trial, was to eliminate an important element, then maybe that would become an undisputed, or at least become a fact that's settled. But here it seems as though this whole matter, and I'm not sure how the other side is going to address it, but comes down to what she can see. And with the officer saying that he reached to his back and pulled out something, and at least is it undisputed she didn't see his hand, and in fact that could have happened. So what you then have is simply the testimony of the officer, but nothing that she can offer can refute that part of it.
Well, that's partly what the trial judge tries to do. But the problem with that whole scenario is that the testimony of the officer was that Miss Borden was in front of Mr. Boggs. He then pushes her to the ground and then reaches behind his back and pulls out a wallet. Now, illogical is the best way to describe such conduct, where you got an officer who's standing 10 to 15 feet from you, he's got his gun drawn, and it's aimed at you, and then you throw the woman who's standing in front of you to the ground, and then you reach behind your back suddenly to pull out a wallet. I mean, you'd have to be deranged to do that. But let's assume that we don't have to assume. We know that the officer says that. But Ms. Borden is alive, and she testified not only at trial but in her deposition and in the statement she gave to the police, that he never threw me to the ground. We were standing when the officer approached, and that he never reached behind him, as the officer said, and he never grabbed anything, such as a wallet or anything else. And how do I know this? Because when he fell, I immediately went to his side, I kneeled next to him, and I looked at his hand, and there was nothing there. So even if that was what the trial judge was focusing on, there are no undisputed facts that would support that position. And that's what we're saying, that you have to have undisputed facts in a case if you're going to take away the right to have a jury decide what the facts are. And in this case, the undisputed facts are that Gregory Boggs was unarmed. The undisputed fact was that Linnea Borden was there. And the undisputed fact was that there was blood on the back of Linnea Borden's pants, which clearly indicates that she couldn't have been off to the side when he was shot. Otherwise, no explanation for the blood on the pant back leg of her pants exists, other than, as she said, him sliding down her back after he was shot and bleeding on her pants.
Is it undisputed that she didn't see his hand?
It is undisputed that she, at what point?
Point that the officer describes him reaching for this, whatever it is.
She testified that he never reached behind his back.
I thought she testified he raised his right hand.
He raised his right. She testified that at the time the officer said, put your hands up, he raised his right hand. His left hand was around her body. And that she raised one of her hands, and before she could get the other one up, the officer shot. Now, that was her testimony.
So it is disputed that she, as to whether she saw that hand, because it's raised. I
mean, well, she didn't see the hand as it was in the air. You're correct. She could not see his hand. But at that point, no one says that Mr. Boggs had anything in his hand. It was only after Mr. Boggs supposedly pushed her to the ground, which she disputes. And it was only after Mr. Boggs then reached behind his back, which she disputes. And it was only after Mr. Boggs was on the ground that something was supposedly in his hand, which she disputes. So all of the indicators that Mr. Boggs did anything to provoke this is in dispute. And therefore, summary judgment was entirely inappropriate under the circumstance, just as a directed verdict was inappropriate when it was moved for, just as at the close of the plaintiff's evidence, just as it was inappropriate at the close of all the evidence.
Are we permitted to treat the summary judgment for purposes of directed verdict if we decide that the evidence would we should procedurally move in that direction as opposed to summary judgment?
Well, I don't think that you can ignore that what happened here. I mean, there was what the trial court did was he denied the motions, and I don't think that this court can revisit those points. What he did was he directed them to file another motion for summary judgment. So I think we have to look at it from the perspective of what actually happened here.
They never renewed their directed verdict motion. What they did was file a motion for summary judgment, correct?
Correct. That's what the trial judge told them to do.
So there's no open motion on the directed verdict. The motion is for summary judgment.
No, Your Honor, there is not. And so I think that once you look at it from that perspective, I mean, there's just no undisputed facts. I mean, if ever there was a case where there are no undisputed facts, this is it. I mean, we're not in a situation where the only live witness to the shooting is the police officer. We have a live witness. And her testimony was clear, succinct, and unequivocal in terms of what happened here. And I believe that on that basis, it was improper for the court to have done what it did. My time is up as far as the argument.
Got some time reserved, Mr. Lowe.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Shelley Johnson, Associate County Attorney, representing the Appalese, Prince George's County, Maryland, and Officer Swanger. Again, I would like to apologize for keeping the court waiting. The case does come down to the issue of who had the ability to see. And I would suggest that this case is actually a stronger case than that of Anderson. I think what the court has, what Mr. Latimer has not informed the court of is that during the trial judge actually had the ability to see from Ms. Borden, from defense counsel, from Officer Swanger, exactly where the people were when the shot was fired. How did Mr. Boggs have Ms. Borden? He had his arm around her neck.
This is evidence derived during the trial.
This was evidence derived during the trial, yes. Both parties had the opportunity to demonstrate, and both demonstrations showed that Mr. Boggs was behind Ms. Borden.
So your view is, on the summary judgment question, we should view the testimony at trial.
Yes, and I understand the court's hesitation, but Anderson versus Liberty Lobby basically states that the standards are basically the same, and it's just really the difference between the two is procedural. So, you know, if the court wants to look at this and view, and I asked the court to look at the trial testimony, then you would see that the trial judge had the opportunity to see the parties, see how Mr. Boggs was standing, see how Mr. Boggs was holding Ms. Borden, and saw that Officer Swanger had the ability to view both Ms. Borden and Mr. Boggs. In particular, he was able to describe.
Like a jury type way. You know, I hear that. I rarely hear on a summary judgment that, even before trial, you had an opportunity to see these things. It's kind of interesting. Usually summary judgment, of course, comes before the trial. But for the see, it almost is talking about credibility.
Well,
the judge can sort of determine, you know, who's telling the truth and who's not.
Well, actually, you know, it doesn't even come down. You don't even have to touch the issue of credibility. You don't even have to look at the testimony because you're looking at the body positions. I mean, the body's positions alone.
What is the salient fact that turns the case for you?
Is that Ms. Borden was not able to see what Mr. Boggs was doing with his right hand. She and actually, in her statement that was available at summary judgment stage, the IA statement that she gave, soon thereafter, she admitted, I honestly cannot say I knew where what his right hand was doing.
But now, let me ask this. If she is in a position where there's a left arm around her neck, do you necessarily have to see where the other arm is if you're standing right next to the person? And I mean, you could feel it. You could know. I mean, there are other factors that could come into that.
He has his arm around her neck. I am her. Okay. He is right here. And it'd be easier if I had somebody to demonstrate for you. But she is looking at Officer Swanger. Her attention is on Officer Swanger, who, according to her, has a gun and is pointing it at them. And she is looking at him. She had nowhere in her testimony that she says she turns to look at Mr. Boggs and see what he's doing. She's looking at him.
Interesting, though, that jury saw that same testimony you just gave right then, and they didn't agree on it. And you're saying the judge saw it the way one side of the jury probably saw it, and therefore, as a matter of law, it must have been that way.
Well, no. What the judge had the benefit of knowing is he had the benefit of knowing Anderson. And Anderson, there was the same thing. They had spectators who were actually across the street and who were basically looking at it from the same direction as the police officer, and their account of what happened was totally different. There was no knife. No knife was in his hands. His hands was raised when the officer fired the shot. Basically the same thing that Ms. Borden is saying. But in Anderson...
ended in a mistrial.
But and then...
And what you had the summary judgment granted after?
It was a Rule 50 in Anderson.
Right. And what happened was the evidence showed that a knife was recovered on the scene. In this case, a wallet was recovered on the scene. And I noted...
That shows consistency with the, at least in terms of the testimony of the officer. But when you look at the differences of the testimony of the lady and the officer, there are a lot of differences.
Well,
and
now,
what you've got to do in order to be able to get to this point that she didn't see it or couldn't see it, you got to basically say, I can't, all this business about this different testimony pushing to the ground, that can't mean anything. The only thing that means something is this, and I'm going to take this as being true on both sides. Why would you do that in a negligence case or a case dealing where you can just send it to the jury?
Well, Your Honor, well, first of all, I would disagree with you that there were, you know, big, vast differences in their testimony.
Oh, don't leave me there, because I might be off point on that. I want you to help me on that.
I would love to help you.
I thought they had a very different version of what happened. From what I understand, there was this business about them fighting on the ground.
Yes, and that...
Did they agree on that?
Yes, they did, and I'll tell you how. They did, and the thing is that she admitted that they had an argument over this cell phone, and that the cell phone ended up on the ground, and they both ended up on the ground, and when she got it, she threw it a little bit further. And they're still wrestling when she hears a car door slam.
Both bent down to get a phone, and then we both stood up, and he was trying to reach around me for the phone. Wonka says they were fighting in a violent encounter on the ground with his neck around her, choking her.
That she was laying on the ground. And
right.
She says that did not happen. Isn't she in a better position to know whether she was laying on the ground?
Well, I think she is, and she admitted she did. At JA 114, both went straight on the ground for the phone. She tosses it further away. He stood up like he was over me. I stood up. He stood up. We noticed the officer. So it's all a matter of timing of when people see it. Officer
page,
Swanger.
What page was that?
That is the Joint Appendix 117. And so they see it at different points in time. She's not aware of Officer Swanger's presence until the door slams. He's already observed her and observed what's going on prior to him slamming the door. His testimony is that he slammed the door to get their attention, and he did exactly that. Boggs is standing up. He, you know, according to he helps her up. And also what I think we are missing is what this is looking at a perspective from a reasonable officer on the scene, and you have to look at what knowledge the officer had. Just as in Anderson, this officer was responding to a report of an assault, a male assaulting a female near a red car. This was not just reported once, it was reported twice. Officer Swanger came to the scene the first time, didn't see anything, cleared the scene and left. Got a second call, comes back, sees them actually struggling, fighting on the ground, and observes this and gets their attention when he slams the door. That's when she, and according to her testimony, that's the first time that she is aware that someone is there. Officer Swanger had been there for a couple of seconds, and it took him, and when he got out of the car, that's when he got their attention. So they both agree that there was some type of altercation over this phone. Now, she gets up and then she admits that he's holding her around her neck. Now the officer is responding to a report of an assault, and then he sees
to the red car. Wasn't that
the red car was there in the background?
That too?
She didn't even mention the red car.
Oh, didn't mention.
She's not concerned about the red car. She's not concerned about the red car. I mean, she's not looking around her surroundings where she probably would have seen the two people who actually called 911 reporting that someone is fighting, because the caller actually went down the street, turned around because she was so alarmed, and came back to see, make sure her eyes were not tricking her as to what she was actually seeing.
How long did it take for all this to happen? From the time period the officer got there until the time period of shooting, was this
a matter of seconds, Your Honor? I mean, actually, if you're going by Ms. Borden's version of events, it's a matter of seconds. I think Officer Swanger makes it a little bit longer, maybe a minute and a half, as he is giving commands. I think another point.
How do we view a summary judgment? If we're looking at summary judgment, whose version do we give anybody any greater?
Well, first of all, you have to look at the standard. The standard is you're looking at it from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene. What a reasonable officer would have done given the information that he had. And at the summary judgment stage,
in determining that question of law and in the summary judgment phase, how do we view the evidence to support? Do we look at the evidence in terms of one version over the other, or we view the officer's testimony to be equal with that of the lady in this case?
Well, I think you have to give the officer's testimony more weight, because you're looking at a perspective of a reasonable officer, not a reasonable person standard.
Judgment. In these kind of cases, summary judgment. What you are saying is that we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the winning party.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, of course you look at it in a summary judgment stage, you look at it from, light most favorable to the non-moving party. We move for summary judgment, so you look at a perspective from the non-moving party, but in doing so, you have to take the facts and circumstances in light of a reasonable officer on the scene.
I'm trying to understand the procedural history of what happened here.
Yes.
The court actually denied your summary judgment motion before trial.
Correct.
Based on all the things you're arguing now.
Well, based on, yes, on the documentary evidence.
So then how do we get, what's the difference between then, the trial, and now, that suddenly the court grants the summary judgment motion?
Well, I think one of the biggest difference is the demonstrations. I think it's very hard to describe accurately and completely body positions when you are on paper. And it's much easier and in the fact to actually see it. And the trial judge had an ability to see it, not just hear the description as to, and Mr. Latimer explained how Ms. Borden said her right back is to his left front. You know, picturing that in your mind, it may be difficult. I think the trial judge seeing it in front of him is like, yes, I see it now. I got the complete picture. That is the thing that was missing from the summary judgment stage. And then, therefore, I think that it was easier for him to, whatever lingering questions he may have had, to answer those questions and grant the summary judgment.
Did you move for judgment as a matter of law at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case?
At the conclusion of the plaintiff's case, yes.
Okay, and did you move for judgment as a matter of law at the end of the entire trial?
We were going to, and we were instructed to renew our summary judgment.
And so then it went on to the jury.
Well, no, wait a second, I'm sorry. Let me strike that. I misspoke. It went to the jury, mistrial. We were going to renew it again and actually stood up to get ready to say it, and then we were told to renew our summary judgment. So that's procedurally how it went. I think that what we need to understand is that, you know, officers are often had to make split-second decisions, and circumstances are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving. That definitely was the case here in this case.
I'm sorry to interrupt
sure.
you. Did the demonstration that you believe changed the case occur during the plaintiff's case or during your case?
We had demonstrations during both cases. Both cases. Ms. Borden participated in a demonstration with Mr. Latimer's co-counsel, and I participated in a demonstration with Officer Swanger. And in both situations, the body position was Alana Borden was in front of Mr. Boggs. Okay. Now, also, I think the factors that we need also look at are the severity of the crime at issue, whether the suspect posed an immediate threat to the safety of the officer or others, and whether the suspect was actively resisting or attempting to evade arrest by flight. And in this case, we're dealing with an assault, which is a serious crime. The officer, based on what he saw going on, the struggling on the ground over the cell phone, the way he was holding her around her neck, the fact that neither one of them, in response to commands to show your hands, no one said a word. No one said a word. Ms. Borden did not say, oh, don't worry about it. This is my boyfriend. We're having a little fight. We're okay. I'm fine. She said nothing. And then according to Officer Swan, from his perspective, seeing her being held around her neck and him moving her, in the background, a red car, which had been reported to him as a car to look out for, it shows that there was a reasonable belief that Mr. Boggs was trying to move Ms. Borden away from the scene and that he was attempting to leave. Now, the courts have consistently held that an officer does not have to wait until a gun is pointed at him before action is taken. So he doesn't have to wait to make sure that this is a gun or whatever. We also know that there is no requirement for certitude to proceed on acts of self-protection. It is clear that Officer Swanger, he articulated very clearly, he was looking at Mr. Boggs, he was not responding verbally, he was not responding demonstratively, He did respond by his eyes getting big. He watched his nostrils flare. He saw him lower his center of gravity. And this was not two motions. It was one motion. He said he saw him push Ms. Borden aside and go behind his back. That is when he made a decision to take action, fearing for his own safety, which is shown because he fired once and fled for safety behind his police cruiser. So those things are clear, and Also, I would say that Officer Swanger was entitled to qualified immunity. He believed that he was acting in self-defense of himself and Ms. Borden, who he believed was being assaulted by Mr. Boggs at the time. A reasonable officer presented with those facts would believe that they were acting for the betterment of Ms. Borden, at, even though mistakenly, and themselves, thinking that Mr. Boggs posed a significant threat to his safety and her safety.
How the testimony aligns in terms of when the shooting occurred again? I'm trying to understand it because it seemed to me there were material differences between the testimony of the officer who said something to the effect that the victim was pulling down the female. She says no, we were standing up. There was no verbal command of that sort. There was no crouching down. He says there was a crouching down.
Right.
How is that the same thing?
Well, I think that, it, you know, one, I think that it's clear that she is in front of him, and she admitted on cross-examination that he had his hand around her neck. Now, what he's doing with what Officer Swanger did not say, that he crouched completely down, hiding his complete body behind Ms. Borden, who is definitely significantly smaller than he is.
He lowered his center of gravity,
right
behind his back, pulls her to the ground in one motion, and at the same time he's pulling her to the ground, he's coming out from behind
his back.
She says, "No, sir, that did not happen."
Right.
We were standing.
Right.
How is that aligned?
Well, and I think that if you take it just half of her testimony, that's what you would get. If you look at her complete testimony, including the cross-examination, and when we break it down slowly, you would see that...
We could, based upon that testimony, assess her credibility and determine she is telling something not true. Is that what you're saying?
I was saying that you don't even have to look at her testimony because... Really?
But you got to say she's lying or not telling the truth in order to be able to get to the point that she wasn't being pulled down. If she said she was pulled down, it wasn't pulled down, and he said. And basically you're saying look at all her testimony, and then you can conclude that could not have been correct. Is that where we're going?
No, Your Honor, I think that where we're going is that if you look at all of her testimony, and you see that, one, that there really is not much of a material dispute. What she tries to do is minimize what the contact is and minimize the contact in the context of what was going on.
So my difficulty is that, yes, everything you say sounds very reasonable, but why does the judge make this determination? Why doesn't the jury make a determination of this sort? You got this evidence. She said this is what happens. He said this is how it happened. You got other evidence that could point one way or the other, and maybe a lot of it's in your favor, but isn't that a jury question?
Well, I think in this case, and this is not your typical summary judgment case because this was done after a trial, and so we know that the judge did give the jury a chance to make this determination. The jury came back and said, we can't. We can't.
Doesn't that show there was a genuine issue of fact?
No, I don't believe it does. I believe that...
Just give it to another jury.
Well,
it happens all the time. You get a jury that says, well, it doesn't happen all the time, thank God, but it does happen. You just say, okay, we'll get another jury. Maybe we get one that agrees on this.
Well, I think that if, you know, I think the reason why you don't and why...
We might as well settle these things here. Why might not come back to us.
No, I think the reason why the trial judge didn't in this case and why it doesn't have to be done in this case is because of Anderson and because of what this case is even stronger than Anderson because Anderson, and this is the big difference, is that, you know, in Anderson, the spectators were across the street and looking at the same vantage point as the officers, and the Fourth Circuit didn't have a problem with that, that there was discrepancies and major discrepancies. But in this case, Ms. Borden is in no position to see what's going on behind her. And a trial judge knows that, and knowing Anderson knows that this is how I can resolve these inconsistencies because as the court in Anderson really noted, is that minor discrepancies in testimony do not create a material fact in excessive force claim, particularly when witnesses view the events from a worse vantage point than that of the officer. And that is clear, and that's actually on page 131 of Anderson for the court's interest. And for all of those reasons, we ask that the district court's ruling be affirmed. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Latimer, you have some time remaining.
The appellees basically are saying, forget all the law that has been established regarding summary judgment. Forget the fact that Rule 56 requires that the evidence be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-movement, and says, well, accept what the officer says because the officer is more credible.
Well, what the district judge said was, after I've seen this demonstration, it's clear to me that she couldn't see what was going on behind her, and that her testimony is inconsistent with the forensic evidence based on where he was shot. She couldn't have been standing where she said she was standing. Otherwise, she'd have been hit instead of him.
Well, so again,
that's the way I understood the basis for his ruling.
Well, unfortunately, he didn't say that.
He said it in his opinion.
He never said anything about a demonstration.
Well,
what he said was that it couldn't have been that way. And you take the testimony. First of all, that makes no sense.
Wait a minute. When he says her testimony as to her position at the time the shot was fired is inconsistent with the forensic evidence, what? How do you characterize that?
Her testimony, exactly that. Right. Her testimony, which was my right back was against his left chest, and the demonstration that Ms. Borden gave was not that she was in front of Mr. Boggs, but she was off to the left. The demonstration that the appellees gave using Officer Schwanger showed that he said she was in front. She never, ever said that she was in front of him. But if you just look at that, if she's on the left side, the officer is on the right side, he gets shot in the right side of his chest, and the bullet is moving right to left, how do you come to the realization that that's inconsistent? And the trial court should not put itself in a position where it's making factual determinations.
Tell me about this. You know, I'm trying to think about trying cases. I used to love to do that, but this is interesting, that now we're being asked to look at a demonstration. Was that demonstration described for the record?
No.
That's the question I was going to ask.
It wasn't, and that's the thing.
Feel good.
I mean, you're basing this demonstration on what they say it was about. Well, I was there.
Well, I'm just trying to get this, put my arms around this to understand. You got a demonstration of what goes on, and yet typically when that happens, one of the counsel will say, for the record, Your Honor, the arm is around the person, she's standing at this distance, or that sort of thing, and then you got something to review. But I don't know what the trial judge is seeing. I other than it says that's what the end result. Unless there's something here that in the record that has that actually. I guess there's nobody's videotaping this thing, so I don't know what.
That I'm positive of. It was not videotaped, but I don't believe that there was a description and of the nature that you're speaking of. And I do agree that normally you do have descriptions of that kind. The record will reflect that they're about X feet apart. The record will reflect that this is happening, but that's not here. But you do have the testimony, and the testimony of Ms. Borden is she was on her right back, is on his left chest. He was shot on the right side because the officer was on the right side. And her testimony is also, I mean, to say that there's no material disputes as to what she says very clearly and unequivocally that the officer approached, told him to get your hands up. Mr. Boggs raised his hand. She raised one of hers. She couldn't get the other one up because her thumb was underneath his arm. And at that point, he shot.
The forensic evidence, is that opinion testimony?
That is an autopsy report.
And is there the report itself, is it just the facts of the auto autopsy report, or is there opinion testimony that as a result of this, the only place he could have been standing was here and this is how
none, happened? None. The forensic evidence that the judge is talking about is an autopsy report that indicates that he was shot 2 inches to the right of the midline in the chest.
But there was testimony by someone to get the report in, and that person did not render an opinion?
No. There was no opinion as to where you would have had to been standing. Because you can't make that determination. I don't know of any expert that could make that determination because there's movement of people all the time. And if you're shot in a particular instance, just like if you're shot in the back, there's testimony from experts that will tell you that it doesn't mean that a person saw your back at the time that you were shot, that you could have moved and therefore you were shot in the back. But this whole business about what the facts were, I mean, for instance, take the self-defense. He was defending Ms. Borden. Well, how do you justify that? How is that even rational when the police officer is running away? And the police officer testifies that he fires and he runs and he leaves Ms. Borden there. Well, if you're defending Ms. Borden and you have some idea that this man is supposedly assaulting Ms. Borden.
Don't confuse me. Keep me on this shooting thing.
Okay.
I understand this forensic report.
All right.
And part of it was because I'm interested in the evidence that was presented at trial. It's an autopsy report, medical examiner. He testifies, I guess, as to the location of the wound. Is that right?
Your Honor,
No need to do that. I'm just trying. We can
get. I am.
I'm trying to understand at least what is the nature of the forensic evidence, such that it is of the nature that it can counter, it can determine as a matter of law that she is not in this position to do it. And is that evidence in the form of direct evidence or is it evidence?
There is no evidence of that kind. There is no evidence.
Or is he testifying to admit the report?
That's it. There is no evidence of any kind indicating where the individuals would have had to have been standing in order to be shot in the position that he was shot, which was one bullet wound to the 2 inches to the right of the midline of the chest. There is no evidence supporting where individuals would have had to have been standing.
The trial judge makes the determination that her testimony is inconsistent with the forensic evidence, which showed that he was hit in midline of his chest. And I'm trying to figure out who gave that opinion that it is, or where is that evidence that says it's inconsistent? That's not a question of law. That's a question of fact.
There is no fact in that regard. In fact, I mean, it's not even the trial court is not even accurate in terms of where the bullet wound is. It was not at the midline. It was 2 inches to the right of the midline. So the trial court doesn't even accurately state what the autopsy shows. Not only does he have that wrong, but there is nothing. The trial court made that determination. And that's why we say it's wrong, because the trial court has no business making decisions of that kind and then ruling in favor of a moving party for summary judgment as if this is a fact and as a matter of law, a determination can be made in that regard. I see that my time is up, unless there are any other questions, Your Honors.
No, thank you, Mr. Latimer. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then we'll go into the last case.
Thank you.